This is PRN.FM, your source for progressive radio that makes a difference.
And now, hi, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here with Polar Levine, a.k.a. Polarity One.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good night.
This is News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have a full program of some very interesting subjects. First, the Bradley Manning trial. Alexa O'Brien, who covered that trial every single day, who did transcripts of the trial when the government wasn't and refused to, and who also just interviewed the defense attorney. His first interview since the 35-year sentence handed down to Bradley Manning. We're going to hear a piece of that in a minute. And later in the show, we're going to take you to some people who know a lot about Egypt, and we're going to try to find out what's happening there and also whether or not the United States should or should not cut off military aid to this new General Sisi administration in Egypt. So that's on the agenda here on News Dissector Radio. Stay with us.
James Raymond, Almost Gone, a song about, actually, was a song about Manning or about Snowden or the issue in general. Either way, it works.
And that's what it's about, and that's what we're all concerned with here. Certainly, we have been following this case of Bradley Manning closely, and we've been very pleased to have Alexa O'Brien on the program before. Alexa, are you with us now?
I am.
And
how are you?
Are you coming back from the actual courthouse now?
I actually am. I'm en route to, you know, an undisclosed location after having covered the trial for 3 months this summer.
Well, you deserve a more than one undisclosed location. You deserve many. I wanted to start the program today with part of the interview you did with you know, Bradley Manning's lawyer. Tell us a little bit about that interview. We're going to play a little selection from it.
Sure. So during the deliberations for the verdict, so not the sentence, but, you know, his conviction, I was in the courtroom, and as I was walking out, Mr. Coombs came out, and he said, Alexa, I just wanted to tell you that I'm going to do my first interview with the media with you, because I've just been very, you know, just want to reward the work that you've done. And I was very grateful for the opportunity to actually sit down with him. I mean, it happened literally within a half an hour after the verdict came down, and the verdict was 35 years.
Tell us a little bit about him, your impressions, and how he conducted the defense for Bradley Manning. He was under tremendous pressure.
Mr. Coombs is a masterful litigator. There's no question about that. Whereas other litigators are for the military, for example, the military prosecutors, you know, you can see their punch from 100 miles away. So they're very obvious. They're very, you know, grandiose in the courtroom. Bombastic is the word I've used because, you know, they're talking about terrorism and al-Qaeda and classified information. But on scrutiny, they just sort of lapse into that kind of mantra.
Which I call government windbaggery. Okay.
Right. Now, you know, and the counterpoint to that is Mr. David Coombs, civilian defense counsel for Bradley Manning. He's got an incredibly likable court manner. He's very respectful. And the thing with Coombs is you don't see his punch coming. He's very, on cross-examination, he can disarm a witness and then go in for the strike. And he'll go in for the strike with a smile on his face. When I say go in for the strike, I mean impeach the witness or destroy the testimony, especially if it's a government witness.
He was appointed by the court. Is that true?
No, he wasn't. He was actually found by Bradley Manning's aunt, Deborah Von Alstein, he was actually solicited to represent him in addition to the military counsel provided by the Department of Defense.
Oh, I see. I didn't understand that. That's still a heavy assignment for somebody to agree to take, knowing, you know, all the media attention on him, knowing, you know, how divisive in many ways, you know, this trial has been.
And knowing he's going to lose.
Okay.
I think he's done a fantastic job, because I think that had he not represented Manning, Manning would be in a much worse position. Coombs is an educator, and he's a natural educator as well, as having had that on his resume. And so he has a really great manner of explaining things into the courtroom that are complex. And you have to understand, this has been an incredibly complex trial with 22 charges. It's 3 years long. There's so many facets to it, from the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to the espionage charges to the aiding the enemy. And a lot of it has been unprecedented, the way in which the government charged the case. And here we have Mr. David Coombs is also former military, so I think in a certain sense he was able to float between the two worlds, the world, the civilian world, as well as the world of the military court-martial, and to do it in a way where he advocated strongly for his client, but he also was always able to communicate exactly what he needed to say to his audience in a way that would be able to be heard by all the different members of his sort of, you could call them constituency, Bradley Manning supporters, the military judge, the press, although he has avoided any kind of contact with the press outside of text-based documents and things of that nature.
It seems like, you know, he was not trying to build Manning into a martyr, but he was trying to defend him as a client, as someone who was charged with a crime or a series of crimes, and try to convince the court to let him, you know, off. Obviously, we didn't succeed on that, but, you know, a 35-year sentence, which means that Bradley Manning could be out in 7 years after facing first a life, you know, life in prison and or 136 years, I think it was. So, I mean, it's quite an achievement for him, wasn't it?
It definitely was quite an achievement. And he's done it in a way that I think will stand the test of time. And what I mean by that is, he showed complete candor to the court as a litigator. I mean, clearly he's an advocate for his client, Bradley Manning, but as of today, Chelsea Manning.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a minute. Yeah.
So what I was saying was that he has, you know, it will stand the test of time, because his advocacy was completely earnest and sincere, just like Manning in the courtroom. He advised his client, you know, towards pleading to the offenses, the lesser included offenses he felt his client should plead to. He educated the judge in a very sort of meaningful, long-term, strategic approach, educating the judge about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, educating the judge about many different issues. Like one of the things we talked about that will come up in an extended interview that will be published in the next couple of days, is he never intended to go with a panel of officers or enlisted persons for Bradley Manning, because he knew that the trial was taking place near the NSA, and there was no way that a panel would understand or have mercy on Manning for leaking classified information.
Let's hold off for 1 second. Let's give the audience a chance to hear this man in his own words. Also, if you'd like to join our conversation, talk to Alexa O'Brien, you can do so at 888-874-4888. That's the call-in number here on PRN.FM, 888-874-4888. Now, let's turn to your interview with Mr. Coombs that appeared on Democracy Now! And also was carried by the Real News Network. Mr. Coombs.
Well, I look at the sentence and I can't believe that was actually the sentence he received. Anyone who sat through the hearing heard all the evidence, even in the closed sessions. There's not evidence there where you would think 35 years would be the appropriate sentence. I wonder now if there had actually been damage, or if he had really intended to harm the United States, or if he wanted to obtain personal gain from selling classified information, just what the sentence would have been. because this was a person who had true intentions. He wanted to help America. He wanted to get people to think about what was going on in Iraq, and he didn't have an evil motive in what he did. You heard from the sentencing his background, his story, and yet that was the sentence he received.
And how is Bradley Manning?
Interestingly, he was the person who had probably the most cheerful mood afterwards. There were a lot of people who were very upset. He said, hey, it's okay. It's all right. I know you did everything you could for me. Don't cry. Be happy. It's fine. This is just a stage in my life. I'm moving forward. I will recover from this. So it was odd that I wasn't the person who was trying to comfort him. It was just the opposite.
My sense, I don't know Bradley Manning, but my sense is that he's
back
grown
to
up
this in
this
a second. If we can,
process.
If we can hold this for a second, I want to get Alexa's comment. Now you're sitting there listening to this very calm dissertation, telling us that Bradley Manning was less upset than his lawyer, less upset than certainly his supporters. What insight did that give you into Bradley Manning's disposition?
It confirmed what I've seen in the courtroom for the last, 19 to 20 months. Bradley Manning, now wanting to be referred to today, as of today, as Chelsea Manning, is an incredibly strong character in the courtroom. Is a dynamo, really. And one of the amazing things about Manning is one always underestimates Manning. I really want to kind of respect Manning's wishes. Today, as of today, wishes to be referred to as Chelsea and is going to start to transition through hormonal therapy to living as a woman. So I'm going to refer from this point forward to Manning as she. She has been incredibly dynamic in the courtroom, incredibly earnest, sincere. And I think Manning's ability to rise above circumstances is another incredible aspect of this trial and the story. I think that there's a strength to Manning that's underestimated by people that fundamentally prevails in all circumstances. So the government has, tried this case and gotten, in many senses, its way. 35 years, wanting to put Manning away in Fort Leavenworth forever, as much as they can. And they might get that opportunity in the short term after they've completely slandered Manning and, done everything else. But fundamentally, the truth and the earnestness that underpins Manning's acts, whether or not they were completely wise in every aspect of their, disclosure, Manning even admitted, he was young and he didn't think everything through. But fundamentally, his intent was good, and I really believe that in the medium to long term, that Manning is going to have a complete reversal, and many people will come to understand how powerful her acts were, and also what kind of amazing young person this is.
You saw the pictures of Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning. Now, I'm glad he chose Chelsea because I live in Chelsea, so I can identify with that aspect of it. I'll bet you Chelsea Clinton may be trying to change her name now, not to be associated. But the point is that was a very brave and honest thing for him to have said today. And, we've seen him in these photographs surrounded by these tall guards who are armed, and he looked like a very meek personality, but yet here is a man and woman now of tremendous conviction.
Yeah, I mean, there's something very real and true about Manning, and I think that the sort of strength of Manning's humanity is ultimately the most compelling aspect of having just watched this trial. There isn't a grandiosity to it. There's actually a great humility. I mean, even pleading to the government for 10 lesser included offenses, stipulating to avoid having the government have to bring out all these witnesses to prove their forensic case, coming into court and apologizing. At the same time, also coming into court and saying, this is what I did it for. I saw people being murdered indiscriminately, and I couldn't live with myself. And all these kind of the complexity of
the situation in Iraq, the reality of it, is what I think drove a lot of people who were interested in the case into really making sure that the government didn't get a chance to completely rewrite history, that there's a record somewhere that people can look to see for themselves what actually happened here. Because fundamentally, I think that that Manning has actually opened a complete age, a new age, a new political age within the age of information. And I think that it's only forward from here, regardless of whether, you know, one constituency or not wins the war on overclassification or doesn't win that war. The battlefield and the landscape has been drawn out by Manning.
Now, what's interesting here also is, of course, a 35-year sentence. How many people convicted, soldiers convicted of war crimes in Iraq got a 35-year sentence? I mean, I saw that there were people being let off on 10 months, 6 months, after it was proven that they were part of, extremely violent acts.
That's right. The New York Times, in fact, their op-ed today had said that it had used the example of a soldier who murdered an Iraqi man at a checkpoint, and he only got 25 years. And here we have Manning, who didn't harm anyone. No deaths resulted. Certainly there was a lot of mitigation efforts by the U.S. government to make sure that, you know, they understood what was in the releases and that kind of stuff. But fundamentally, he gets more time than this soldier who murdered someone.
Second question about Manning, then I want to ask you a few questions about you, okay? But first, about Manning, today's announcement by Manning that he is going through this hormonal therapy, that he has changed his name to Chelsea, and you know, many of the media organizations that have been consulted about this feel it's totally appropriate to accept someone's own definition of themselves, how to regard, you know, to treat them. I remember this early on, the case of, Muhammad Ali. You know, there were many sports writers who refused to call him Muhammad Ali, you know, even though that's right, what he called himself. They were calling him Cassius Clay, you know, for months after he actually said, I'm no longer Cassius Clay, I'm Muhammad Ali. So I think your decision to accept his definition of himself is something that I think will reverberate through, you know, the media world, hopefully, as well. But what actually did he say today, and what was the reaction to it?
Well, his lawyer went on to NBC's Today show this morning and presented a letter that Manning had written requesting that she be referred to as Chelsea and the feminine pronoun be used when referring to her. You know, the reaction to it has been a lot of, you know, hand-wringing and sort of like the academics have come out and started to, you know, write dissertations on it. And I think that's important because, you know, the public does need to be educated about these issues. So I've seen a lot of people sort of, throwing journalists the AP style for discussing individuals who are transgendered and the like. And that's all great. Fundamentally, for me, it's not a really complex thing. I mean, here is somebody who clearly has, in the court record and has said that they have gender identity issues, which some people even take. Sorry, there's a train behind me, so just bear with me.
That's okay. We're happy that you're here.
You know, right,
I didn't think you'd make it onto the program, given everything that you've been through and the fact that you're on the road coming back north after devoting so much of your life to covering this trial.
And the fact that all your emails have been looked at, and now here's a train coming in your direction.
So tell us, Alexa, you know, how did you first decide to cover this trial? And what is that, as you think about it now, after this whole long, you know, drawn-out affair has taken place, how do you feel about the work that you were able to do and your colleagues have been able to do? Whoa, I think we may have lost her. Let's try her again. In the meantime,
I wonder if I wasn't joking.
In the meantime, I mean, let's say that this woman is and a small group of other reporters who've been bravely covering this trial, while most of the major media didn't show up and didn't really mention it and didn't really explain it very clearly, you know, deserves a Pulitzer Prize in my mind, you know, for her unswerving work here and creative work of recognizing how a journalist can actually not only be helpful to her own story, but help everyone else by maintaining a transcript of what was actually happening in the court when the government didn't want one, literally would not allow an official transcriber to be there. And she took on that role. And in a way, her documents, her transcribing became, you know, a document of the critical journalists who were there, who were trying to bring more attention to this case, in large part because we're trying to bring more attention to the war crimes in Iraq that this case is centrally connected to.
You know, I'd love to know where the Tea Party stands in all this. You know, the party of taking our precious freedoms away by having health care, for instance.
Well, this is a big issue on the right. You know, you see that some of the conservative websites are finally talking about the role of the NSA as a violation of American liberty. It's taken them a while to do it because they have a very strong, you know, commitment supposedly to, you know, standing by our troops and supporting, you know, national security, vigilance, et cetera, and so forth on the borders and in the world. But, you know, they themselves are being victimized by this. And I think some of them have come to recognize that this is an abuse of government authority, you know, certainly in the NSA matters. And in fact, just today, the New York Times reported that one of the national security courts criticized the NSA. Hello, Alexa, are you there? She's calling me on my phone. Can we have your number? Can we call you right back on your phone? Okay. We'll make this happen, all right? Thank you. I was hearing this buzz. I said, well, who's calling me in the middle of my show? Well, it was my guest, Alexa O'Brien.
From under a train.
Under a tree or under a train. So we'll have her back on in a second.
But, you know, that seems like a fantastic premise for uniting the right and the left. There are issues that both sides agree on.
One would hope so. I mean, don't forget that this video, collateral damage video, that Manning really released to the public and WikiLeaks released to the world, showed, you know, journalists being attacked and killed by American forces there. And certainly one would think that the American media would, if nothing, for no other reason, rally behind the, you know, this case. So, okay, Alexa, you're back with us. You didn't get hit by the train. tell us now, I was asking you about, you know, I know it's a little early maybe to process all of this as you have to take several deep breaths coming out of that environment in that courtroom, which is, I'm sure, very claustrophobic and controlled and constrained by military rules. How are you feeling about all this now?
I'm very satisfied, and I feel like that I know my work isn't done on this particular trial, because there's, now that the trial is over, I feel like the story can actually be told to the American public about this trial. Things that are of great importance to them to know, because this trial really was historic. It was almost like the Scopes trial, in the sense that it was a marker of the change of times, the question about what the public has a right to know, and the importance of knowledge in a democracy, the role of the press, the health of the press, and then also the story of this young person who really was the most unexpected individual and character to sort of take on the might of the U.S. government and its propaganda machine, and yet continues to, you know, every day surprise people. And people try to write Manning off, but Manning is going to keep on coming back because there's something fundamentally powerful about the bedrock of truth and integrity and intent within the complexity of this larger story.
Now, the activists who support Manning are calling for a presidential pardon. Last night, I ran into Barry Scheck, the head of the Innocence Project, one of our great criminal defense lawyers. And I said, what are the odds of him getting a pardon from Mr. Obama? And he held up two fingers with a big zero, you know, suggesting he didn't think that that was going to happen in any way. What is your thought about that?
I think that, you know, I think that he's probably right. I mean, here we have an administration that prosecuted this young whistleblower, and they're very unlikely to turn around unless it's politically makes them look badly. Who knows? I mean, you know, I think the internet fundamentally is a piece of this particular campaign that might be underestimated by the government. Manning is a folk hero and will only grow in stature now that this trial is over and people don't have to walk on eggshells around losing press access.
All these years later, one of the great heroes of the Vietnam War is Daniel Ellsberg for releasing the Pentagon Papers back in the 70s. And, you know, to this day, he has the respect of so many people for having defied the government. And actually, you know, the New York Times in those years was, I think, a lot more courageous in publishing, you know, the Pentagon Papers. But we, you know, we have a situation here where with the Snowden case and with the Manning case, seems like a lot of the so-called mainstream legitimate media has in their craven need to appear balanced, has actually done a disservice to the coverage of the case.
I completely agree with you on that. I think part of it is that the institutions have been corporatized. And so they have to appeal to their shareholders and the mentality of a sort of sociopathic institution and not the sort of benefit model that they had when they were privately owned or there was more philanthropic sort of model to the press. Or I think that, you know, in many ways we have pumped out a bunch of journalists out of journalism schools and they're kind of like factories. And this sort of the issues of what's a public benefit also have become much more complex as our own society, our own country has become much more diverse.
I would give a shout out to Charlie Savage of the New York Times, who seems to have been very diligent on this case. And of course, Glenn Greenwald, who has given this whole issue a tremendous global visibility in a very courageous way. Laura Poitras, you know, Jeremy Scahill. I mean, many journalists who've been fighting this media war, this information battle to get the truth to the people of the world about these cases. And the reality is, despite their, you know, prosecution of Manning, you know, the various polls showing that this issue is not has not really won support for the Obama administration, quite the opposite.
I think that the Obama administration's, and I'm going to call it even something more monolithic, the U.S. government, because I really don't think there's a difference whether it's Obama or, you know, let's say McCain, if McCain was in the White House. I think that this kind of hardline approach to whistleblowing, the kind of sentence that came down in the Manning case, is only going to embolden those who do have infinite courage, like Manning, to continue acts like this, civil disobedience and whistleblowing acts like Manning did. And so I think that they've miscalculated.
Well, you may not say this, Alexa, but let me say it. I think you have shown tremendous courage under fire, and your colleagues, Kevin and you know, Nate and the various people who have been diligently trying to bring information to the American people about, you know, this case. And I think you also should, you know, at least be acknowledged for the role that you've played, which I'm extremely proud to know you. And I'm really happy that you have come on again to talk about this case, because this is something, the issues raised in this case are not going away by any means. And this battle is just ongoing. And I think Bradley Manning is not going to disappear in people's hearts and minds.
I think you're right. And, you know, I just want to say something. I have a tremendous amount of respect for you and for your own legacy. I mean, I know that you covered actually the Pentagon Papers. And so I'm actually very grateful, because I know that you've taken an interest in this case. And it's been those individual actors within the institutions, like the, you know, New York Times, although I think Charlie Savage is a great reporter. I don't think he covered the Manning case, you know, very closely, but that doesn't matter. He was covering other stuff. Fundamentally, it's people like Jeremy Scahill and Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald and people like you and people like me, you know, each in our own way, that are going to fundamentally be the, you know, ingredient for winning this larger battle for public accountability,
of our government institutions, reasonable policies, and really actually writing the mania of the post 9/11 interagency process, which is now being honed in on anything the government considers a threat.
And what's next for you, Alexa, very quickly, because we have to wrap up now.
So much. I'm applying for a grant, an investigative journalism grant. I'm going to be writing a book on the trial, and there's other things that are in the works. But first, I'm going to take a break for 5 days.
Please do. Alexa O'Brien, thank you so much for coming back on News Dissector Radio and talking with us and reporting to us about the incredible role that you've played in helping to bring this case to public attention, and also to talk about what really was going on in that courtroom. I don't think we've heard the end of it yet, and I'm sure you'll be there to help us find out more. So thank you, Alexa O'Brien.
And watch out for oncoming trains and cars.
There you go. All right, so we were going to go back to the Coombs interview. We can't do that now. Let's just continue on the program. Thank you. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about Egypt and the crisis there. That's the song 70 Virgins by Polarity One, Polar Levine, who's in the studio with me. We want to now move on to the issue of Egypt, which is, of course, in the news. We've seen a week of massacres taking place in Cairo. We've seen the former president of Egypt, dictator Hosni Mubarak, being released by the military. We've seen a crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. We've seen actual calls to exterminate the people from the Muslim Brotherhood. We've had a fierce debate about what the U.S. response should be. The United States has, you know, cut off some help for Egypt, but not the continuing aid and assistance. And the question is, should we or should we not, given this human rights horror show that's taking place there? The Egyptian military has basically running roughshod over what the hopes of the Arab Spring were, the hopes of for democracy in Egypt, seem to be really, you know, being held in abeyance right now. And so I thought we'd turn to some people who've been following the Egyptian crisis more closely to share some of their thoughts with us. And at the end of the program, we want to say goodbye to a great jazz singer who lived here in New York City, Satima B. Benjamin, South African jazz artist who just died in Cape Town on Monday. And we have a song of hers to go out with at the end of the program. So Talib Kane is with the IPS, Interpress Service, based at the United Nations. Robert Naiman is involved in trying to fight for a just foreign policy. Both of them have been very concerned about the issues of what American policy should be and critical of what American policy is. So let's begin with you, Talib. Tell us what the latest is from Egypt today and what your assessment is.
Do you want to talk about the weapon sales or about the political situation in Egypt?
Well, let's start with the situation today, the latest developments.
Yeah. They're planning to release Hosni Mubarak, and I'm sure it's going to have quite an impact on what's going on. And it's a pity this is happening, particularly at a time when Egypt is going through this crisis. You know, and it will definitely have a negative impact. And I don't know whether there will be an increased demonstrations against this move by the courts, but probably with the backing of the interim military government.
Well, initially, the interim military government was set up supposedly to preserve democracy, which they claimed the then government, the elected government, the Morsi government, was violating. And so they, with a lot of popular support from people on the left or pro-democracy people, they intervened supposedly, to establish democratic rule. But what's happened, it seems as if the military has really imposed almost like a fascist rule in some areas with an aggressive campaign, which includes killing as many as 1,000 people. I don't know how many people have been injured in this process. Many people who were protesting peacefully were attacked by the military. And now the question is, what should our policy be towards this? Robert, you've been following this closely as well. What's your take on that?
Well, number one, we have to be clear that we have laws that apply to the situation. There's a law in the Foreign Assistance Act that U.S. aid must be cut off to any country where a democratically elected government is overturned by a military coup. This is clear-cut U.S. law, which until now has not been implemented. The Obama administration came up with the novel interpretation that they don't need to make a determination whether a coup took place. This is something they, even in the coup in Honduras, they didn't say that. They said, well, we're studying it. They didn't come up with this new theory that they don't even have to make a determination.
Right, so this was a coup that wasn't a coup, okay, in official parlance.
We don't have to have an opinion on whether it was a coup or not, even though historically, actually you could say this kind of started with some of the coups in Latin America, like the coup in Honduras. Some precedent there of people saying that a coup is not a coup. But historically, there's a clear-cut notion. You have a democratically elected government, and the military comes in and says, you're not the government, and hauls those people away to prison. That's a coup. But that was, historically, there wasn't any doubt about that.
If it quacks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, it's a duck, right?
Right. But not only that, we have other laws that apply to the situation. For example, there's the Leahy Law, which requires that U.S. Aid to any military or police unit must be cut off if the unit is credibly alleged to have been involved in gross violations of human rights. Well, credibly alleged, we have it on TV that the Egyptian military and police gunned down hundreds of protesters. We have the Armed Support Control Act, which is supposed to control the use of U.S. Weapons. So the law has not been applied. The Obama administration has said in recent days, we're moving to cut things off. They've taken some gestures. They, to the extent that they had any excuse at all for not complying with the law, it was this. They said to people in Congress, okay, give us some space. Let us, try and negotiate with the generals. Let's not just cut everything off immediately because we'll lose all our leverage. Well, then, what we saw was the coup and the series of massacres, including especially the massacre last Wednesday.
I mean, I haven't seen much leverage there. If all the reports seem to be that the Egyptians told the American government to go stuff itself, wasn't paying attention to their pleas and their requests and their, various warnings and all the rest of it, and decided to do what they wanted to do, irrespective of what the United States said. And we're talking about, over $1 billion here in aid, and yet the United States has been extremely tolerant here and seems to be loving the more ambiguity the better.
Okay. Yeah, it seems that there won't be any congressional pushback either because of the Israel lobby and the defense
that's actually
lobby.
More complicated in a very interesting way. Yes, it's true, the Israel lobby has been pushing, and the Israeli government has been pushing to say no, don't cut off the generals. But there is a split among people who ordinarily closely follow AIPAC, Israel lobby, and the Israeli government. So, for example, you know, Lindsey Graham. Remember Lindsey Graham from the Hagel confirmation hearings? Not generally considered somebody that doesn't have a good relationship with the Israel lobby. But both Senator McCain and Senator Graham have been among the voices criticizing the Obama administration for not taking a firm stand against the coup and the repression. So the fact that the Israel lobby is in the mix, saying don't cut off the aid to the generals, may not be decisive in this case.
Talib, what's your take on this?
Let me just explain.
At the United Nations. The Secretary General of the United Nations has expressed concern about this. What is the UN's position on all of this? And what is the Security Council doing, if anything?
Not surprisingly, the Secretary General has been towing the U.S. line, and he has refused to call this a coup. And this has been over and over again. We have been asking this question at the briefing, but he refuses to commit himself. The Security Council is not doing anything, primarily because of opposition from the Russians and the Chinese, just like what's playing out in Syria. But the more important question is, why isn't the U.S. Cutting off military aid? As you know, the total foreign ministry financing, these are all grants, non-repayable, and they are $1.3 billion that Egypt gets every year, and almost all of it has to be used by only American weapon system. The Egyptians cannot use the U.S. grants to buy either British or French weapon system.
This is an important point that I don't think many people understand.
Right. And more importantly, the Egyptians don't even see this money. It goes to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, then to a trust fund of the Treasury, and finally it goes out to U.S. military contractors who make the tanks and the fighter jets that ultimately get...
So, in a sense, this is the lie, if you will, the big lie.
Right.
Foreign aid, which is really it's like American aid to American companies. That's what
exactly,
it's about.
Exactly. It's being plowed back into the American economy.
You see, so one of the reasons I think that they don't want to cut off the aid is because they'll be cutting off support, a kind of a stimulus program for the American military-industrial complex. So this is, you know, a self-interest here, big, strong economic self-interest that the Obama administration knows the American people don't really understand, but
nevertheless
does not want to create any hardships for any of the big military contractors. Am I right on that so far?
And you know that since the Camp David peace treaty, Egypt has got $40 billion in U.S. military aid over the last 34 years.
Not bad.
$40 billion. I mean, that's
so
we're basically
financing the Egyptian military. The Egyptian military, in some ways, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Pentagon. But now with the Saudis playing a big role there, maybe Qatar, I don't know what their position is. It seems like the Egyptians have calculated that the United States cannot afford to cut off this aid. Is that right, Robert?
It's clear that the Egyptian generals have called the bluff of the United States, and apparently with the encouragement of the Israeli government and the Saudi government, they called the bluff of the United States. Whether that assessment was correct is a battle that still has to play out.
What's your take on the Turkish suggestion that Israel was behind this in some way? You think that's just propaganda, or is there some truth to it?
I don't think there's any question that there's some truth to this. The New York Times reported the same thing. We didn't need to go to the Turkish government for that. I mean, there's more than one actor here. So anybody who says that this is all Israel, no, of course it's not all Israel. There's a bunch of people in the room pushing their agendas, and the Israeli government is one of them, and the Saudi government is another.
The Israeli government behind the coup or behind the United States not wanting to call it a coup?
Both. According to Western press reports, there's some dispute about one aspect. Western diplomats have said they believe that Israeli officials and Saudi officials were encouraging the generals to ignore the U.S. and European diplomats, both when they said, don't do the coup, and when they said, don't do the massacres. And the U.S. and European diplomats thought they were close to a deal to defuse the confrontation, and they believed that the Israeli officials and Saudi officials were telling the Egyptian generals, you don't need to listen to the U.S. and Europe. The U.S. will never follow through on its threat to cut off military aid. The Israelis dispute the claim that they told the generals to ignore the United States, but they don't dispute the claim that they're lobbying Washington and other Western capitals not to cut off the generals.
Don't both the Saudis and the Israelis, for their own reasons, hate the Muslim Brotherhood, want to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood, or certainly weaken it significantly?
Yes.
Right.
For their own different reasons. But one of the things I think we should ask is, you know, in whose interest is the policy that these governments are pursuing? You know, the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt did not touch the Camp David Treaty, did not stop security cooperation from Israel, between Israel and Egypt. In some ways, they intensified it, much to the displeasure of many Palestinians in Gaza. So what's at stake here is not, you know, the safety and security of the majority of Israelis. Yes, the Israeli military loves their cooperation with the Egyptian military if there's no democratically elected Egyptian parliament to get in the way, just like the Pentagon loves their cooperation with the Egyptian military if there's no a parliament to get in the way. But that doesn't mean that this is a policy in the long-term interest of the majority of Israelis, who, after all, I think have an interest in normalizing their relationship with public opinion in the region, not being perceived to be on the side of repression.
Thank you, Robert, for joining us. Final thoughts, Talif. What will happen now?
Yeah, across a home, I think there's also another angle to this story. As you know, most of these defense contractors are based in states like Ohio, Michigan, Alabama, Florida, and Pennsylvania. And I was wondering whether the senators and congressmen who represent these districts would ever support for any cutoff of aid, because some of the major defense contractors include Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Electric, Boeing, Sikorsky, General Dynamics, and Raytheon, amongst many others.
Well, so, you certainly tie all that together to a strong set of interests in keeping the flow going to
right.
Egypt, irrespective of the character of the government, which is certainly cannot be accused. They claim that they're not a coup, but I certainly can say they can't claim to be a democratic government or movement either, because they're acting in a very authoritarian, anti-democratic, if not straight out fascist manner. So
yes, absolutely ruthless.
Yeah. So I want to thank you guys for coming on the show. I just called them last night. Both agreed to be with me. I think you've offered some very important insight into this. This program, by the way, is going to be, is going to be in my blog tomorrow, the URL for it, so you can actually listen to it and share it with others at newsdissector.net. Your comments are welcome at dissector@mediachannel.org. The new media channel is up, and we're featuring interviews with media activists of all kinds. There's a brilliant one, I say myself, not because of my questions, but the answers from Moyeli Sawori of Sahara Reporters from Nigeria, really talking about a media project that they've launched that I think a lot of Americans could learn from as well. So that's on mediachannel.org. Before we go out today, we want to pay tribute to a great South African singer. When people who are involved in the struggle in South Africa die. They say Hamba Kale. So this is from the Cape Times. Hamba Kale Satima B. Benjamin, jazz artist Satima B. Benjamin's contribution to jazz was immense. Her death was a sudden and sad day for music. She died at age 76. She's the former wife of jazz legend Abdullah Ibrahim, a.k.a. also known as Dollar Brand, and the mother of musician Sachwe Ibrahim and the internationally renowned rapper Jean Grey. Her death was unexpected. She was a person who was very respected by the whole South African struggle. She was part of it. Beautiful soul who touched so many, said one of the people who worked with her. So we'd like to go out today with one of her songs. She was, when she came to America, Duke Ellington was so impressed with her that he became her, in a way, sponsor in America, and did a lot to promote her work. And she worked with people like Billy Higgins, Kenny Barron, and Buster Williams. She performed at the Cape Town International Jazz Festival, and she lived here at the Chelsea Hotel in Chelsea, New York. And I was proud to know her. She was a great friend of our families, and we're going to miss her a great deal. So Hamba Kale Satima B. Benjamin. Her song is so beautiful, and it had to start buffering right now. This is what happens, unfortunately, when you don't have the actual recording. People no longer have records; they use CDs, and this just happened. So I didn't get to bring one in today. I'm sorry. At least you heard a little bit of our voice. With us, Pilar Levine. You've been working on lots of different musical projects as well. Do you want to mention anything or talk about any of your recent work?
Yeah, there's. I have two fairly recent albums of free downloads of political material. One is called Free Money, But You Have to Pay, and the other called is Occupy This, and you can get it on polarity1.com.
So, you know, there's some music from a music maker and a person of conscience who are also proud to do this show with every week here on the PRN, Progressive Radio Network. I don't know if we can get that song back on or not. We can. Okay, so at least you had a little taste of it. Check her out on YouTube and other places, Satima B. Benjamin, great jazz musician, and certainly a fixture in the New York jazz scene for so many, many years. Thank you for joining us here on PRN.FM. We'll be back next week with another program and do it again. In the interim, we'd really like to ask you to please pass the word of this program on. It's in the archives at PRN.FM. We're also on iTunes, I believe. And you can rate us, you can support us, and you can get the word out about this weekly show, which tries to cover current issues of importance and as well as cultural phenomena. So that's what we're here to try to do, and we're glad that you are here with us today. We hope you'll be back again with us next week. And you know, I'm stretching a little bit, but you know, it really is, why am I doing all this? I just this week got a new book out called Radio Free Boston, the story of WBCN, the station that I used to work for, and we'll be talking with the writer of that book as well.
Ah, she's back.
So let's just hear what we can hear for the next second or two.
Much too long. And I'm glad to say.
that I'm home to stay.